Monday Morning World Report welcomes you to the beginning of a new season and my second year as a regular contributor to Nelson Before Nine. This morning we get a foreshadowing of stories to come and areas of concern that the mainstream media has pushed onto the back burner. Stories like UN reform, peak oil and the rise of organic agriculture, an obscure part of the movement to reduce the debt of developing countries known as export credit agencies, the exploits of several Canadian mining companies in Latin America, and an organization little mentioned in the West called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Somebody gave me a TV this year, so for the first time in 25 years, I've been watching Canada Now and The National every night. Those shows, along with my reading in the coffee shop and on the internet, provided an alarming opportunity to learn how spotty mainstream news coverage really is. As part of the regular process of deciding on a topic for the week, I seek out news missed or consigned to the back pages. One way to do that is to keep my eye out for those lists, such as the one from Project Censored, a media research group at Sonoma State University in California, of news stories that have been overlooked, underreported, or self-censored by the country's major national news media. Project Censored is thought-provoking and a useful list, but its exclusive focus on American stories takes me in a direction I don't want to go. Médecins Sans Frontières has an annual listing, too. So does AlertNet, a Reuters news service aimed at organizations in the humanitarian aid community. And the UN publishes a list of 10 stories the world should hear more about. Once upon a time, there was even an outfit similar to Project Censored out of the communications department at Simon Fraser University, but they haven't published a list for years. So this year, I decided to put together my own list of the top 5 most overlooked stories for Monday Morning World Report. Unlike Reuters and MSF, this list goes beyond humanitarian catastrophes to include political and environmental stories as well. The process of producing it is more subjective than Project Censored and not as scientific as the Reuters study, but it is meant for Canadians. Not that these stories are exclusively Canadian. When the press ignores those events where we aren't included, the public is encouraged to construct a false world in which they aren't even happening, like the first story on the back burner, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. This July, while G8 leaders met in Glen Eagle, Scotland, and Live 8 bands lived it up on rich men's stages, Russia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, all members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, were meeting in Astana, Kazakhstan. Previous meetings of the SCO, which was established in 2001 and represents nearly 50% of the world's population, focused on terrorism, separatism, and extremism. This year's meeting discussed the changing political situation in Central Asia, particularly uprisings in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan in light of the Rose Revolution in Georgia and the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. The Kazakhstan meeting showed that SCO aspires to be a serious force in international affairs. This was especially evident in the granting of observer status to India at Russia's request, to Pakistan at China's insistence, and to Iran. The joint declaration issued at the end of the summit rejected U.S. attempts to monopolize or dominate international affairs and insisted on, quote, non-interference in the internal affairs of sovereign states, end quote. The statement further urged Washington to declare a timetable for withdrawal from Afghanistan and from the Uzbek and Kyrgyz bases in the region. Within weeks, Uzbekistan decided to evict U.S. military personnel from the Qarshi-Khanabad air base, which effectively marks the start of a counter-revolution in Central Asia. More on the SCO in the coming months. several Canadian mining companies are in hot water with authorities south of the border. Canadian mining giant Barrick Gold has proposed Pascua Lama, an open-pit mine at the 4,600-meter elevation on the border between Chile and Argentina. Before extracting some 500,000 kilograms of gold over a 20-year period, the powerful multinational, already notorious for its dealings in North America, Australia, and Africa, will have to relocate significant parts of three giant Andean glaciers. Barrick hopes to transfer the three glaciers to an area with similar surface characteristics and elevation by merging the three into a fourth, larger glacier. In Mexico, a Kairos Canada delegation visited Cerro del San Pedro, a community threatened by Canadian mining company Metallica Resources. They learned that the proposed open-pit mine will destroy villagers' homes, damage the ecosystem, and contaminate the water supply through the use of cyanide leaching. The aquifer at risk supplies 73% of the water for 3 million people that live in and around the nearby state capital of San Luis Potosi. In Guatemala, nearly 200 Mayan mayors paid for a newspaper ad to demand a thorough probe and compensation for the death of Alvaro Sanchez, killed in March near Canadian-owned Glamis Gold's Marlin property in the San Marcos region. The human rights group Rights in Action and Marlin project manager Tim Miller say it appeared the guard shot Sanchez with a handgun owned by his employer, U.S. security firm Golan Group, which protects the mine. More on those stories as they develop. Communities around the world have been alerted to the negative impact on the environment and human rights of international financial institutions like the WTO and the World Bank. Yet lesser-known government bodies, called export credit agencies, account for the single biggest source of debt in the developing world. Unlike the World Bank and WTO, taxpayers are paying for them. What is an export credit agency? Does Canada have one? What kind of corporate shenanigans are we paying for? Well, you might ask. The modern food system uses approximately 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce 1 calorie of food energy, a thoroughly unsustainable state of affairs. In the U.S., agriculture accounts for more than 10% of the country's total energy consumption, and that does not include packaging, refrigeration, transportation to retailers, or cooking. The largest share of that amount, nearly one-third, goes to produce chemical nitrogen fertilizer. If, as many believe, oil production has peaked and natural gas is not far behind, something will have to give. Cuba provides a recent example of fossil fuel famine. In the late 1980s, Cuban farmers depended on cheap fuels and petrochemicals imported from the Soviet Union. They used more agrochemicals per acre than American farmers. In 1990, as the Soviet Empire collapsed, Cuba lost those imports and faced an agricultural crisis. The population lost 20 pounds on average, and malnutrition was nearly universal. Cuban authorities encouraged the formation of small agricultural co-ops, and farmers began using oxen instead of tractors. The government sponsored education in organic methods of food production. Small food animals such as chickens and rabbits began to appear on urban rooftops. As a result, Cuba avoided what might otherwise have been a severe famine, and today grows more organic produce than any other country in the world. While energy use in Cuba is now 1/20th of that in the U.S., the economy is growing at a slow but steady rate. Food production has returned to 90% of its pre-crisis levels. More on this story, too, in the months to come. Finally, the theme of UN reform brings to mind some spectacular failures: the Rwanda genocide, the oil for food scandal, the sexual abuse of African women by peacekeepers, and the need to correct the UN system so that such failures are much less likely to occur. For others, UN reform means an increased number of seats and perhaps vetoes in the Security Council. In either case, UN reformers are up against some formidable and very widespread discrepancies and outright misconceptions. For example, to people in the U.S. and Canada, the UN is little more than the Secretary General, whom we see, from time to time, exchanging news bites with other world leaders on the evening news. We know that Canadian and American troops serve as UN peacekeepers in remote hotspots around the world, places like Cyprus and Sierra Leone, but their activities are never reported in the evening news. At the most, we hear that they have arrived or are leaving. By contrast, in many parts of Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and Latin America, the UN is an active presence. Families receive part of their food from the UN. Some are employed by agencies like the UN Development Program or the UN Food Program. Millions live in camps administered by the UN High Commissioner on Refugees, and so on. UN reform is a story that touches so many lives and is so complex that it should have been in the news continuously since Annan's report, In Larger Freedom, was released in March 2005. Instead, that was the last time it was mentioned on the news. That's it for this Monday. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.